Well, thank you very much for coming out on a cold and not so pleasant Saturday morning, and also 2 weeks before Christmas. It's very good of you all to make the time free. I felt I should almost start apologizing for a rather pretentious title of this morning. I don't usually use titles like transgressive, transcendence, so I got a little bit carried away. So when I started preparing, so did I really give that title? But I must have done. In any case, I do think it does capture it in some way what I want to talk about. As you may remember, last time there was we looked at putting art in its right place, but then the second lecture was on the use of images within the church, within the community of faith, and also the whole debate about iconoclasm, so the iconoclastic controversy. Now, this time we're going to use at the use of religious imagery by artists who may or may not use this in a context of faith, and thus evoke new meanings and associations. And that sometimes does mean that art transgresses certain boundaries for Christians or people from other faiths, and it is experienced as offensive. From films such as The Last Temptation of Christ, Chrysophilis, The Holy Virgin Mary, or a recent statue by Terence Coe at the Baltic Museum of Contemporary Art, which has been in the news. It's generally accepted that over the last 20 years or so, there has been a significant increase in religious imagery in postmodern art. But prior to that, one could say, in the modern period, there was also a strong sense of spirituality in modern art, even though it was not always recognized as such by the critics. So in this lecture, I would like to illustrate the different ways in which modern art and postmodern art express spirituality and transcendence. And I will do so by first looking at some general features of modernism and postmodernism and the way these portray a particular kind of worldview, or, as I will explain, almost like a world feel of life. And then I will look at the implications of that for art. And before I then will go into the actual topic of transcendence and spirituality. Now, I want to start us off with looking at four central concepts, the words we are using in this discussion, which often tend to be used interchangeably and often with very different meanings. Both by Christians and non-Christians, which can often lead to very confusing discussions. And these four terms are faith, spirituality, religion, and transcendence. So now I'm trying to come up with some definitions of these terms and how they are used within the faith community and also outside. Now, the practice of defining is both a descriptive but also a normative activity. You try to, in a definition, try to capture what you think is in people's minds when they use a particular word. But you also feel that in order to use it properly, this is what it should be. So there is a bit of both. It's a description and a normative sense. So, and it's in particularly in the Christian sense, I think we should try to have a true understanding of the words which we are using. So let me start with the notion of faith. Now, usually we think in the Christian context, obviously, there is faith in God and in Jesus Christ. But in many ways, the word faith, or indeed, the concept of faith, the phenomenon of faith, happens everywhere. Tillich talks about the notion of ultimate commitment. You put your trust in something, and that can be anything. It doesn't necessarily mean putting your trust or faith in God. It could as in the modern period is the case, put your faith in science, or put your faith in progress, or put your faith in the family, or you can put your trust, your ultimate commitment, that what you want to die for, could be really anything in life. So it doesn't need to be. So I think we have to distinguish faith in something else and faith in God. Now, the second term, spiritual or geistlich, I have defined as the realm of abstract ideas and mystical feelings. It's a translation from the German, which usually denotes this dual meaning, but the German word does not translate very well in English. It's usually translated as mind or spirit or ghost, but it can also be associated with drive or motivations. So, for example, in translations of Hegel, who uses the word Geist a lot, some people resort to using the word spirit, mind, even. But we can also talk about the spirit of the age, the Zeitgeist, or a Volksgeist, the spirit of a particular people or a nation, or the romantic spirit, etc. Now, when Christians use the word spiritual in a biblical sense, I think what they should really have in mind is the spiritual life. It's not just an abstract realm of ideas or a notion of feelings. It is really a practicing life, spiritual life, in accordance with God's will. And that is how it's used in scriptures. So it's not an abstract thing at all. It's really a very concrete, active, walking in the way of the Spirit. And it is important because when we have these discussions about spirituality, people have different notions in their mind. And of course, we like to think we mean the same, but we often don't. That doesn't mean that that cannot be a precursor for Christian faith. But as such, spirituality means a lot of different things for different people. Now, the notion of transcendence. This is a word used a lot in postmodern thought. And it in that way of thinking, it is something which refers to something which is beyond someone's understanding, which you can have a kind of experience of. So it's more concrete than an abstract realm of ideas or a realm of abstract ideas. But you are very aware that it is completely outside of your comfort zone and completely different from what you are familiar with. And you are so conscious of it that it is total other, total otherness. And again, that word otherness is very central in postmodern thinking, or alterity. In a way, it has its origin in Kant, where it says it transcends our experience in the sense that you never know the thing in itself. But postmoderns have taken this over as this notion of the holy other. A closely related term is the numinous, also often used in postmodern thinking. And that's a term coined by the German theologian Rudolf Otto. He talks about the holy other, or the mysterium tremendum and fascinans. It can also be viewed as an intense feeling of unknowingly knowing that there is something which cannot be seen. So you have this sense that there is something, but you know it's also completely different. And this knowing can overcome a person at any time and in any place. But as the noted atheist Christopher Hitchens pointed out, the point is it's not necessarily a religious one. And he feels we should separate also the importance of the numinous from the supernatural, as he calls it. And then finally, the word religion, which is again a very concrete thing. It refers to the established world traditions, and it is a communally held set of beliefs and practices relating to a divine being. Now, the Christian use is very similar. Right? We talk about the religions in that way, or we refer to it in a pejorative sense, that we say it's dead religion, or it's just religion, it's not living faith. So these are a way of kind of trying to get some clarity in our mind when we use these terms. Now, it's my kind of hunch or thesis, if you like, that in modern times, the notions of spirituality in this sense of a realm of abstract ideas was very prevalent, or even mystical feelings in a more universal sense. But that in postmodern sensibility, the notion of transcendence has come to the fore in the sense of knowing more concretely that there is something, and also not being afraid to use the symbolism of that concretely, but being less committed to it, and also not pretending that it is part of a universal sensibility. Now, all this may seem very cryptic, and I will go through the talk to try and illustrate my point, but just to give you a taste of the difference between modern and postmodern art, for example, in modern art, there's more a notion of the abstract idea, so you have abstract art, which gives this more general sense of spirituality. In postmodern art, there is actually a lot of borrowing of Christian imagery and symbolism and iconography of concrete images, such as the cross, such as the biblical figures, which would never be done in modern art. But without the faith, as it were, without the commitment to those images, it's done in a very detached way, almost like a device for saying, well, we can pick something from there, and we can pick a Buddha from there, and we put it all in our painting, and we say, well, what do we make of it? So there is no sense of faith in terms of commitment to this, but there's also no fear to actually freely borrow from religion. So whereas in modern period, one would never wanted to avoid the established religions and connections to church in this more abstract notion. This is no longer the case. So it's also a difference between concrete and abstract, but also concrete in the sense of an emphasis on the difference, but without commitment. So this is kind of roughly what we are going to reflect on this morning. So let's start then with identifying a couple of major themes in both modernism and postmodernism. And I thought I couldn't do better than just start with a short paragraph by Kant from his essay, What is Enlightenment? And you have that on your second page. And it's a brilliant definition, if you like, of what modernism is about. So Kant says there in 1784, enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity, unmündigkeit, he uses the word. Immaturity is the inability to use one's own reason without the guidance of others. This immaturity is self-imposed when its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in lack of resolve and courage to use it without guidance from another. Sapere aude, dare to know, have courage to use your own understanding, and that is the motto of the Enlightenment. So there's a very succinct capturing of the notion of autonomy, and we are ruled to ourselves, and we are not supposed not only have a rule set by God, but not by other people, other institutions. We should learn to stand on our own feet in terms of our own destiny and our thinking and our future. So very nice captures of this notion of autonomy. So if we kind of spell it out, right, that would mean faith in reason, for example, and comprehensive philosophical systems, a belief that the mind could order the diverse phenomena of life into a coherent systematic framework and thus penetrate life's mysteries. There's a strong faith in science and technology, and with that a strong faith in progress. There is the time of social utopias, and whether that is capitalism or socialism or Marxism, there's this notion that if you organize society well, it will all come right in the end. Strong faith in education, if only people were educated, then we would live in a better world. It's a time of isms, rationalism, empiricism, idealism, strong beliefs in these notions that we will, on our own account and on our own strength, be able to make a better world. So, just by way of contrast, if we listen to Hebrews 8, verse 10 and 11, where it says, "For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them in their hearts. And I will be to them a God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord. For all shall know me, from the least to the greatest." So there's a strong contrast, of course, with the heteronomy or biblical teaching, where we have God's laws written in our heart. So Kant says no laws other than the law in our own understanding. So what implications does that have for art or thinking about art? Well, two in particular. There's also, in addition to having a faith in science, interestingly, a faith in art, and for similar reasons, as a universal language which can ultimately improve life. It's also a form of elevation of people. So if people would have a proper understanding of art, they themselves would become better people, and that is linked to faith in art, redemptive power, that art could somehow save humanity and lead to a better life. And in terms of strong commitments, the same is the case in the world of art. It's a time of isms. They have cubism, expressionism, impressionism, futurism, functionalism. So artists were prepared to defend the approach they used and stood for. So, and again, it's a sign of commitment, of faith in it. So it's a time of manifestos, you could say, and programs, each style proclaiming the way forward to the future. They use the term avant-garde, which is a military term, symbolizing the forward-looking mission of art. Art was even considered to have a prophetic role in the general advancement of society at large. Element can probably be seen most clearly in architecture, Bauhaus and Mies van der Rohe. So houses were means for social reform. And by that they also meant houses which had transparency and clean lines and purism. So you get the picture. Okay, it's a time of the dominant theme, I would say, of the modern period is optimism and belief in the future and progress. At the same time, there is a sub-dominant theme going on, which is spluttering away there. And it's the emergence of dissenting voices which are not so sure about this dominant belief. So there's a secondary theme coming in. It was partly because modernism did not deliver what it promised. There were two world wars, so there was no place any longer for naive optimism in a better future. Modern science could also lead to modern warfare. And more than that, science, they realized, did not only apply to the natural world, but also turned on the world of humans and society. So there was a strong desire to explain and thus control not just the natural world, but also human behavior in particular. So human psyche and feelings and human life as such, and to almost explain it away. And also religion. Maybe it's, it's just desire of unconscious desires or something. So there was an increasing scientification of areas which were previously considered a mystery, but they were now under the dissecting knife of science, which led to reductionism, materialism, or all kinds of reductionisms in a scientific way. Plus, of course, what one realized was a loss of freedom. If all our behaviors can be explained in that way, well, we seem as nature, as much determined by all those natural laws than these things we were trying to explain. If we turn the science on ourselves, we realize that actually our freedom is much, much less than we had initially realized. So there's a paradox. Science is supposed to give man more freedom to control his environment, but the opposite is the case. Man now seems himself determined and controlled by whatever biological urges or his social environment. So this caused a kind of crisis. So the human condition is at stake, you could say. And this was the key question in existentialism. What is man? What is freedom? Sartre said, well, freedom actually, it means we have no choice, or if we have choices, we always have another choice which is not being made. So we're in this constant dilemma. So I'm obviously going through this very quickly. I also know that it's familiar to some of you and new to others, but again, I hope to give an impression of the kind of feeling. What implications does that have for art? Art became a protest voice. It gave voice to these kind of feelings of unease about modernism. There was a cultural movement called Dada, and which saw itself as a revolutionary movement, the same as surrealism, which came out of the Dada movement. So the surrealist works emphasize the notion of the unconscious rather than the conscious, which modernism would do. So both verbally, by means of the written word, or in any other manner. And this was a movement which spread around the globe and eventually affecting all the arts. Not just visual, but also theater and drama and films. It was quite influential. And the key artists would be, say, De Chirico, Salvador Dalí. I'm sure you recognize these names. Giacometti, Magritte, and Ernst. We look at a couple of their works later. So you could say no longer were they contemplating something higher and nobler, but they were staring into the deep abyss. There was an emphasis on fear and agony and despair and very much also on the absurdity of life. It could, after all, not be explained. There's a sense of alienation and sadism and black humor was also central. So I think it is out of this subdominant theme of modernism that there's a continuation to postmodern thought and philosophy. There's a lot of debate whether postmodernism is a movement or a philosophical tradition or a social condition or a cultural experience. And it's probably all of the above. It started roughly around the 1980s as a cultural movement. And it had a strong influence both in academia, in the world of philosophy, and the literary and the humanities, and also in culture in its broad sense. So let's very briefly look at its expression in philosophy. I mentioned there are three key philosophers, Lyotard, Foucault, and Derrida, who were really the spokesmen for that movement in philosophy. Lyotard, of course, had the incredulity and suspicion towards meta-narratives, and he was the one also who coined the phrase postmodern in his book The Postmodern Condition. So he would say any attempt to provide an encompassing and comprehensive God's eye view, as it were, of life is bound to fail. There's a call, in a sense, which we might sympathize with, for humility in the telling of our stories. We can never pretend to speak on behalf of everybody, women, black, the poor. We always speak from a particular point of view. So even when Kant says Aufklärung or enlightenment is man's emergence from immaturity, he actually does mean that literally man's emergence. He doesn't talk about women, nor does he speak about black people, and he's very disparaging about it in other places. So again, when he has that in his mind, this universal notion, it really is spoken from a wild white male perspective. So that's what they would say, and I think they have a point there. So Lyotard said instead, there are always many small stories which together weave a rich tapestry of diverse experiences and meanings. Then briefly on Foucault, who would say knowledge, and that links to the first one, is always ideologically driven. So those in the past who claimed to have absolute knowledge often had a vested interest in doing so, and they would argue for their positions under the guise of rational argument, but in fact they were driven by ideological interest. And then finally, the first of the Holy Trinity, the third of the Holy Trinity, as they are sometimes referred to, Derrida. Derrida famously said, "Il n'y a pas hors texte," there is no outside text, which does not mean there is nothing, that nothing exists outside the text. He's not a metaphysical idealist, such as Berkeley. And he does not deny material reality, but he simply says we can not step outside our language or interpretation. We never see things simply as they are. And I think, again, as Christians, we can resonate with some of that. Interpretation is always an inescapable part of being human and experience. Even our experience is always one interpretation. And we understand the world against the horizon of, say, previous experiences and future expectations. In a way, it's not much different from saying we have a world view. Now then, how did postmodernism express itself in cultural life? And I would like to turn to a poem to start us off there by Brian Eno, who I think captures some of that. I wonder if someone else would like to read that, just to hear a different voice. Anybody volunteer? Martin. So you can immediately sense a complete shift of experience of life than the modernists. I hope you can see the contrast between what Kant said and Eno captures. For a start, rather than having a faith in everything, a commitment, there's a loss of faith, a loss of trust, loss of commitment. There's, I think, a general fear of commitment in postmodern times for anything, in contrast to even the 60s, which is not all that long ago, when you the student revolutions and so on, you stood for strong causes and were willing to protest. That sense is gone. So there's a fear to commit to causes. There's also fear to commit, of course, in relationships, and we see that everywhere around us. To make a commitment to another person for life is terribly frightening for a lot of people. Then we have an emphasis on difference, on particularity, and also on otherness. And I mentioned that already in connection with transcendence. So there's an emphasis on the local over the global, even while globalization and say global youth culture and so are still reigning. On the whole, one wants to think small locally and in terms of concrete particularity. There's a sense of the reversal of image and reality, or surface and depth. There's a need to reinvent oneself, taking on different persona. Of course, for excellence, Madonna, who constantly needs to kind of recreate herself in order to keep the attention. But also TV reality shows. I mean, it's at the end, you don't know what's real and what is actually acted and what is staged and what is authentic anymore. There's a very blurring of these images of what is real and what is image, what is portrayed as such, and where is there still a sense of authenticity. In fact, authenticity itself is very hard to know. I find this also on things like Facebook, where you have to individualize yourself by saying what your hobbies are and what your connections are and your favorite music. And of course, you portray yourself as you want to be seen. You're never going to say who you really are and advertise that to the whole world. So, and I think for people that's very confusing, because you think, well, who am I? And then you, in response to that question, you really say who you would like to be. Yeah? You like to be cool, you like to be whatever. So it becomes increasingly difficult for people in that kind of culture to answer that real question, who you are. So, and the image and reality are very kind of tricky. It's a very tricky relation. Now, interestingly, implications for art. The main thing, I think, in postmodern art is the return of the image and narrative, and from diverse sources. There's a return of representational art, and there's an unashamed almost borrowing from the past, from historical styles or themes or subject matters, from religions, all kinds of things which in the purest modernist art people would not want to have seen with. Because they wanted to shed any associations with the past. They say, well, no, that we are wanting to make a very clear break with all that has gone before. We are the new generation. We look forward. Now, in a way, postmodernism very much looks backward. It thinks itself as in advance, but it's a recycling culture, you could say, in that it uses everything from the past and just hodges it up, mixes it up, and says, well, what's happening now? I mean, it's like stirring all these things in it, and then standing back and saying, well, that's interesting. And something else comes out of it. And sometimes something interesting does come out of it, but it's not done with the sense of, I'm going to say something, or I want to portray something. There's as much detachment from the artist towards their work as there is in life, as it were. So, therefore, also, artists are no longer accountable in that sense. They say, well, that's what came up in my mind, or that's how I see it. So there's a rehashing. You have that also with retro styles. People like to be having a room in their 60s or in their 80s style or 80s parties and so on. So there's a juxtaposition of different themes and styles and techniques, sometimes leading to very creative solutions. I think in music, for example, of the linking of Jan Gabarek with the Hilliard Ensemble. I don't know if anybody knows the music, but he's a jazz saxophonist. And what he does with the Hilliard Ensemble, which is a Renaissance vocal ensemble, is wonderful. So it's something, again, which would never be done in a modern period. That would be so impure. You would have to do it in the right style. But the mixing of styles can actually lead to very creative results. But ultimately, you could say the reason that these playful associations take place is because there are also no no commitment to them. Another example is the clear is the postmodern fascination with kitsch, for example, and it's almost a double bluff. Because they say, well, look how sophisticated and savvy I am. I know that it's kitsch, but I'm not investing anything in it. So I'm just having a little bit of fun, and the shallow garishness of it is what I'm just find enjoyable. Because I'm not saying that I really think that it's great art. So ultimately, postmodernism is a sensibility, I would say, a worldview filtered through the way we experience the world. Sometimes I use the word world view even for it, because the notion of viewing is almost a more detached spectator. But it's something you're immersed in. It's less something to pin down in a statement than to sense in the shift of values and preferences as they are expressed. And so let's turn one more to that page. I started a list of what you could say are modern values or preferences and postmodern values and preferences. And I contrasted, say, in modern terminology, you would have a preference, and that would be used in a positive way if you say certainty about something. I'm certain that this scientific experiment has that result. Now, in postmodernism, certainty is not a popular term. You would say doubt is much more honest or something. And then you can contrast universality with particularity, global and local, clarity and ambiguity, identity and difference, sameness, otherness, totality and fragmentation, center and margins, that came out in that poem by Eno, presence and absence, pattern or rupture, order, disorder, predictability versus risk, seen, unseen, continuity and discontinuity, stability, change, answer questions. You get the idea. And you could make this list, I mean, 3, 4, 5 times as long. And I'm sure once you have a few minutes, you could come up with other examples. So, having sketched something of these different sensibilities between a modern and a postmodern outlook and their implications for art, I will now turn to the way that expresses itself in spirituality and transcendence in modernism and postmodernism. So let's start with modernism. it was Kandinsky who, in his book The Spiritual and Art, introduces the notion that colors and lines and shapes can create different feelings and emotions, and that is what Kandinsky referred to as their spiritual qualities. So again, the German would be geistlich, which is contrasted with material, as it were. That is almost the easiest way to think about the non-material, or in Kandinsky's understanding also feelings. So the red created a particular feeling, or a curve created a particular notion. He almost has a dictionary for it in his book, that certain things create certain feelings. So, and this was a means for him to transcend the physical material world. There was a desire in general to strip painting from any representational suggestion. Barnett Newman said that in completely denying that art has any concern with the problem of beauty, we are freeing ourselves of the impediment of memory, association, nostalgia, legend, myth, or what have you, that have been the devices of Western European painting. And Rothko similarly said, the familiar identity of things has to be pulverized in order to destroy the finite sensations with our society increasingly enshrouds every aspect of our environment. But even so, that was only in order to intensify the emotion, so not just to make it, to strip it down. And the emotions about the real identity, not to erase them, but to bring the drama out of life in its essence. And this was connected to their desire for what they would say spiritual emotions, without the crutches of organized religion or doctrine or symbolism and its localized practices.